These are exciting days at Reasons to Believe. Recently, we've had more requests from skeptics than ever before to do interviews and take part in debates. We're producing record numbers of books, articles, and videos. And our scholar community has never been stronger, with more than 90 scholars from a wide range of disciplines. We owe a lot of this growth to a very special group of people, our monthly partners. Their faithful support ensures a strong foundation for the ministry so that we can keep moving forward. And because you're a good friend, I know you want to reach more people with the message that science and faith are allies, I invite you to deepen your relationship with Reasons to Believe by becoming a monthly partner today. It only takes a moment to sign up online, and your monthly gift of any size will join with the gifts of more than 1,800 other monthly partners to make sure we're ready to seize the new opportunities that God sends to us. Will you become an advocate for truth by joining our monthly partners today?
Visit reasons.org/MP.
Welcome to Straight Thinking, a GPS for the Christian mind, teaching you how to think, not what to think. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. On today's podcast, does science have operating limits? Can, with the rise of science in a modern world, some people see no limit to its capacity for making virtually everything better? But does science indeed have limits, and does it at times operate on faith?
Yes. And that's what I want to talk about. I'm working on a new book, and there are three chapters on science. So, Dave, you're going to have to go through them thoroughly and correct any errors that I make in my limited science education. But there are people in the world today who are leading scientists, and I think that they have moved past just the operating of the scientific enterprise. I think they've engaged in a philosophy of science, in what I'm calling scientism. Mm. And I think we saw it in the distinguished scientist Stephen Hawking. I think we see it in Lawrence Krauss. I think we also see it in Richard Dawkins, Peter Atkins, maybe even Sean Carroll. I think we see people who have adopted science, but don't think that it has necessary limits, that it moves beyond that. So I want to talk a little bit about this question. What are the limits of science, and how do we respond to it from a Christian point of view?
Ken, you know, it occurs to me as you mentioned the word scientism. I read an article by J.P. Moreland, and he has a book on this.
Yes.
Of course, scientism. And I think if I remember correctly, he defines it as the idea that the knowledge obtained from science holds primacy over knowledge obtained in other disciplines. Is that somewhere along the lines?
There is a kind of a strong scientism and a weak scientism.
Okay.
Let's start with the weak scientism. Weak scientism says that science may be the preferable way to knowledge. Doesn't mean you can't get some knowledge through philosophy or through religion, but science is the preferred, or it is maybe the better way. Strong scientism says that all knowledge comes through science. Strong scientism has no real place for any of the other areas of knowledge. So, you have somebody, I mean, when I listen to Lawrence Krauss at times, Peter Atkins, Richard Dawkins, Stephen Hawking, they at times, even Sean Carroll, they give you the impression that it's really science that's going to tell you real knowledge about the world. The other areas are going to be opinions. And so I want to take that apart a little bit and kind of address it.
Terrific. Okay.
So when we talk about the limits, I think, first of all, we need to talk about people's view of science. And I think people have a very strong appreciation for science, Dave, because science works. If you look at, for example, in the last 100 years, look at the advances that science has brought in the areas of medicine and technology. I mean, when I go to my doctor, he insists that I have blood tests. And he doesn't want to talk to me about a course of improving my health until he's looked at all the numbers, you know, and he'll cash out all this information. And my cholesterol is too high, or my blood pressure is too high, or my blood sugar is too high. How do we attack at this kind of thing? People live longer, and many people think it's because of science and technology. People have better quality of lives, and many people think it's because of science and technology. Let me read this quote from Alistair McGrath. For goodness sakes, Alistair McGrath has three PhDs, all from Oxford University. That's quite an educational accomplishment. Yes. One of them is in the area of science. I can't tell you technically what it's in, but he has one in science. He has another PhD in kind of intellectual history, and then he has a doctorate of divinity. Well, here's McGrath.
He's a polymath, huh?
He is a polymath, echoing back to a previous program, indeed. McGrath, in an article entitled Faith and the Limits of Science, he says this: the natural sciences represent one of the greatest intellectual achievements of the human race. They have opened up new ways of thinking and cleared the way for a deep understanding of the way the world is. You know, I think Christians need to appreciate science. I think Christians need to appreciate how science has given us a remarkable ability to understand the natural world. And I think Christians can also be excited, because I think if we look historically and philosophically, Christianity has had a close relationship to science. There were scientific ideas that came out of the Greco-Roman world and out of China and out of Babylon, and many cultures have contributed ideas and thinking about math and scientific ideas, but science was birthed once. The scientific revolution took place in the middle of the 1600s in Europe. And I think historically Christianity has shaped science. Now, that's not to say that there haven't been some challenges along the way. People, for example, look at the life of Galileo and his battle with the church. And where is the earth? What's its relationship to the sun? And that whole discussion, lots of non-Christians look at that and say, well, obviously, Christianity is an impediment to science. It gets in the way of science. Then the coming of Darwin in the 19th century, Darwin and his theory of evolution, many people look at science and say it's naturalistic, it's evolutionary, it has no place for God. But the reality, and this is sometimes depicted as a warfare view, that Christianity and science have always been at war with each other. I think that, yeah, there have been challenges at times, but the vast majority of the period, Christianity and science have had a position of being allies, not enemies. But I think it's important to appreciate that when science is done well, it is, again, in the words of Alistair McGrath, one of the greatest intellectual achievements of the human race. And that is a very powerful thing, to be able to say, for example, that Einstein was able to look at the world through the prism of mathematics, that's a remarkable thing. So our lives are changed. It's an incredible thing to see the depth of understanding. Now, of course, the question is, are there limits to science? And what I want to say is this. I think there are people, and I'll echo back to a debate I had up in Fresno. There was a professor at the University of Fresno, which is a distinguished university, a very, very strong science school, by the way. And he was a professor of evolution, and he and I were on a radio program together. And he went first, and I went second. And he, as part of his presentation, he says, as a scientist, I have no beliefs. And I was kind of stunned by that. But here's the point I want to make. I think that sometimes people think the remarkable thing about science is that it is purely a method. And if you follow that method, you will discover knowledge and truth. But that method has no connection to other beliefs. It is, in a sense, viewed as functioning neutrally or independently from other belief systems. All the time that I've been at RTB, I get to meet scientists, not just the staff scholars like Dave here and Jeff and Fuzz and Hugh and AJ, but I get to meet a remarkable number of visiting scholars. And I will often, when they discover that my background is in philosophy, we'll have a little conversation and I'll ask them, why does science work? And a lot of times they'll say, well, it just does. That's the remarkable thing about science. It is this practice, and you don't have to have any pre-commitments to any other belief system. You just follow this out. And so religion and philosophy, they just give you opinions, but science gives you knowledge. Now, I want to challenge that idea in a very strong way. I think the misunderstanding there is that science is neutral, that science has no pre-commitments to other beliefs, but that's not the case. The reason why science was birthed and got an independent standing and then flourished was in large measure because the context for science was provided by a Christian worldview. Dave, there are times when I listen to Krauss, when I listen to Sean Carroll, Stephen Hawking, Richard Dawkins, Peter Atkins, that they give me the impression that science is neutral of any worldview conditions. And I think that that's a big, big mistake.
Right.
Now, let's then talk about the preconditions of science. And we've talked about these many times, but I think it's a good opportunity. There are certain things that science depends upon. Science is not neutral. Science depends on certain things being true. Paul Davies, getting all these names in my mind. Paul Davies, physicist, cosmologist, winner of the Templeton Prize. He says, in a sense, science works on faith. Now, that rankles a lot of people when you say something like that.
Sure.
But what he means by that is that science operates on certain preconditions, and it's not like science went out and proved these things to be true through the scientific method. Rather, these are assumptions or presumptions that science is built upon. So what are they? Let me give you eight of them. The first one is that there's objective reality to the cosmos. That is, this is a mind-independent world out there. There's a real world out there. This is what I said to this professor from the University of Fresno. I think it's Cal State Fresno or one of those particular schools.
Cal State University Fresno.
Fresno.
That's here in the central part of California.
Yes. I said to him, don't you believe there's a real world out there and it's mind independent? That is, this isn't an illusion. this is a real world out there, that it is an external reality. Number two, the basic intelligibility of the cosmos. I think it was Paul Davies who said that one of the things that really strikes him, maybe keeps him up late thinking at night, is why is the universe intelligible? Why is it that we can actually, to some extent, understand it, Dave? There are things about the universe we can comprehend. Now, there's a lot of mystery. There's a lot of things we don't know. We have to. One of the critical, could I call it, virtues of being a scientist is humility. There's a lot we don't know, right? But it is intelligible. Now, of course, another element of that is, and humans have all the qualities built into them to be able to understand it.
Yeah, as opposed to, say, an animal, which doesn't have that ability to, I mean, maybe it's appropriate to think that the world is real and it does have uniformity and homogeneity and
yeah.
But the animal has no connection to it.
That's right. I mean, a bear can navigate the forest a lot better than me. He's got smelling, you know,
right.
Multiple times better than me. Maybe smell food miles away, can navigate. Maybe birds can track, you know, the sky. But the universe is not intelligible to the animal kingdom.
Right.
But it is to humans. So one, the objective reality of the cosmos. Two, the basic intelligibility of the cosmos. Third, that the universe has order, regularity, uniformity. Now, of course, we don't know that by experimentation. But, Dave, what good would experiments be if in one part of the universe it said this and in another part of the universe it said something completely different?
Well, in a sense, you could argue that we, by observation, we see that it has uniformity. And so there is a way in which, but you wouldn't be able to do the experiment if you didn't believe that there was that your experiment was measuring something that you could then conclude was uniform or not uniform.
And these are again presumptions. Now, the way I would say that, Dave, is that there is kind of a confirmation of these
things.
Yeah, that's
the right way to say it.
But these are taken first. They're not proven first.
Right.
They kind of come behind and say, well, yeah, our experiments seem to confirm this.
That's
truth.
In the same sense that science works.
Yeah, yeah. Number four, the validity of mathematics and logic. Now, this gets into a lot of philosophy and theology. Why should we necessarily think that a brain that evolved by purely natural processes would give you logical truths about the world? Where did math come from, and why would you ever think that mathematical theories that maybe you invented would actually correspond to the world? Now, of course, and this is the point I made to the Fresno professor, if God exists and God created the world and he is the author of math and logic and he created us in his image and he created the world to reflect logos and nomos, logic and laws, and networked us together, well, then we're off and running. But what if there's no God? And what if the universe is just a brute reality? How do we explain these things? Let's see, that would be four. Number five, the basic reliability of cognitive faculties and sensory organs of human beings. I remember it was C.S. Lewis who said, what if I was pouring a glass of milk and the milk spilled over onto the table and the image of the spilled milk corresponded perfectly to a map of London? Well, this I think gets us at these issues of the problem of human reason. What if something accidentally came to be? Would you expect the accident would actually correspond to a map of a particular city? I think that these issues, again, relate to to do science, I have to be able to trust that my cognitive faculties function properly, reliably, not necessarily perfectly, but they function properly and reliably. And my sensory organs, I can see and I can hear, I can test. I have to be able to trust these things.
Ken, if this were not true, and Dave, you can weigh in on this as well, would it be the case that when we take our instruments and measure the heavens, that if all these were not true, we wouldn't be able to, for example, make a cosmic or microwave background radiation map?
Wouldn't be able to measure anything,
yeah,
because you always got a different answer every time you made a measurement.
That would be frustrating.
I mean, you know, that does happen, by the way, in the lab, that your instrument gives a different value every time you make a measurement. But the first thought that you have is, there's something wrong with my instrument. Somebody's buggered it up, or it isn't working right.
Well, and you think about that. I think it was Francis Crick that says the human brain did not evolve for the purpose of doing science. He talks about, you know, maybe at its primitive level, to be able to pick bananas and throw rocks, stay alive.
Right.
But again, and I'm getting ahead of myself, but that's okay. If God exists, and if he created the world for a purpose, and if we're made in his image, then you can see that theology and philosophy gave a framework for science. So let's, again, one, the objective reality of the cosmos; two, the basic intelligibility of the cosmos; three, that the world reflects order, regularity, and uniformity; four, the validity of math and logic; five, the reliability of human cognitive faculties and sensory organs; number six, the congruence, I like that word, congruence between the human mind and physical reality. I mean, that struck me. I only took one physics class, and I struggled in that class. I did get an A, but I struggled in it.
Hmm.
But I was struck, why does math work? Why should you be able to come up with a mathematical construct and that could actually correspond?
Which is a product of your mind.
Which is a product of your mind, after all. But then it corresponds, like Einstein. So this idea that there is a congruence, but remember, we're accidents. We're the product of blind mechanistic natural processes. These are difficult. Seven, that an acceptable criteria for an adequate hypothesis exists. That is, the scientist begins with the idea that I should have a framework or a criteria that I can narrow and focus my hypothesis. These are, again, ideas shaping that idea. And then number eight, that what is observed in nature can provide clues and indications of unobservable patterns and processes. I think that's intriguing in itself, that I can observe nature and that will tip me off that there are things I can't see. That'll tip me off and indicate that there are patterns and processes that I cannot detect or observe
directly.
Yeah. So here are eight preconditions for science. And again, it's not like all of these were nailed down scientifically. This is what Paul Davies is talking about, that science operates based upon certain philosophical considerations. And those philosophical considerations, may I tell you, don't work in every worldview. It'd be very difficult, I think, to be a Buddhist, with all due respect to my Buddhist and Hindu friends, I think it would be very difficult for science to develop if you thought, for example, that the world was an illusion, or it's just Maya, or as the Buddhists say, the universe is a beginningless, endless. Where would the Big Bang fit into these kinds of things? So worldview considerations, and I think it's a mistake then to think that science is philosophically neutral, that it's independent of any belief systems. I think the reality is that science works because it operates largely, and now I'm quoting Paul Davies, in a theological worldview perspective. And here's the challenge, Dave. I think that when Peter Atkins and Richard Dawkins and Lawrence Krauss and Sean Carroll and others who would adopt kind of a scientism, they want to insist that science can give you real knowledge about the world, but they don't realize that science as a practice, as an enterprise, comes attached to philosophical preconditions. And that's where I think some people really admire science. And I meet atheists all the time on Twitter and Facebook, and they tell me, look, you don't need all those opinions. You don't need all of that philosophy, religious nonsense. All you need to do is follow science and it'll lead you to truth. And my frustration with them is they don't realize that science is not neutral. It has deep preconditions that come with it. And not all of those conditions will fit with every worldview. And I would respectfully ask the question, would science itself as an enterprise, as a venture, have emerged and been as successful if the worldview of the time had been naturalism?
Wow. That's quite a question. Ken, it appears to me then that people of the type that you described earlier, Sean Carroll, Lawrence Krauss, Dawkins, and many others, it looks like they are importing these ideas without lending credence to them. Is that the case? And if so, is it because they're so busy in their areas of specialization that they haven't thought it through? Or what do you think is one of the reasons for that? And you can go back to the debate partner you had at Fresno, for that matter.
Well, when I talked with him, I said, you know, I was very surprised to hear you say that you have no beliefs. And then I just went through that list. And I said, you know, the reality is that science is not neutral. It's not independent of worldview philosophical considerations. It's a remarkable enterprise. It's stunning what the natural sciences have produced, but it fits in a worldview context. Now, Paul Davies would say, for example, and he did so in his Templeton address, that the context, the theological context, has faded. That's 300-400 years ago now, after all. We're talking about 1650. You know, we're moving closer to 2050. So it's 300-400 years ago, the theological prism has faded. But Davies' point, and by the way, he got attacked when he said this. He has an article, Taking Science on Faith. And wow, talk about some unfriendly scientists taking you to task. Davies thought they misunderstood him. He was in no way downgrading science. I mean, he's an eminent scientist. He was simply saying that all of us have preconditions. All of us have assumptions. All of us have a worldview. And I think, Joe, to try to focus on your question, I don't think that we have a grounding for scientism. I mean, scientism, for example, would say the universe is all there is. Let's all go back to Carl Sagan. The universe is all there is, or ever was, or ever will be. Well, that's not that. Here's the problem with that. There's no experiment that tells you that's true. That's a philosophical assumption. That's a place you start with. Another idea within scientism would be something is not true, so it would either be false or meaningless unless you could prove it scientifically. Well, the idea that something is only true or valid if it's proven scientifically has never been proven scientifically.
Yeah.
So when people become very impatient with philosophy, and you make comments like philosophy is dead, Stephen Hawking, that's a philosophical sentiment. The reality is no worldview is philosophy independent. No worldview is independent from metaphysical or religious ideas. Science is a remarkable mechanism. And when it is in the lane of understanding the natural world, I agree with Alistair McGrath, it's breathtaking. It is amazing. I can understand why a lot of intellectual people are attracted to science. What they miss is it is not neutral or independent of worldview considerations. And absent those things, there's no grounding for it. Now, what I want to do is I want to take those eight ideas and kind of divide them into three categories. So I think to understand the preconditions of science, number one, you need the right kind of world. It has to be a mind-independent world. It has to be a world that's uniform, patterns, regularity. It has to be a world that's intelligible. So you have to have the right world. But then second, you need the right kind of human being. You need a human being, for example, that has intellectual faculties, and these faculties, they work properly, they function properly. You can see, you can hear, you can touch. And so you need the right kind of person that can track the intelligibility. So you have to have the right world, then you have to have the right human being, but then third, you need the right congruence between the two. I mean, What if math was invented by human beings? What if it was just something just popped to us? Well, why should those conceptual ideas correspond to reality? I mean, I have a lot of ideas, and sometimes my ideas don't correspond to reality. I mean, sometimes we have people who we think are mentally ill, and part of what tips us off is they have all these ideas that don't correspond to normal, the way the world normally operates. So you need the right kind of world, you need the right kind of human being, you need the right congruence. Now, since we're back to this issue, which of the worldview options best fits with this? Well, why were the early Christians so behind science? Why was Christianity such an encouragement to science? Because God is an infinite, eternal being. He has all wisdom and all knowledge, all power. He created this world. He created it with nomos laws and logos logic. Then he created us in his image, and he networked us together. So understanding the work of the Creator was logical and rational. And it brought glory to God, to see God's works and the benefits from that. So that's a very important part of that. And again, we relate to the limits of this. Do I think that there is worldview borrowing? Yeah, I don't blame Peter Atkins, Sean Carroll, Lawrence Krauss, Stephen Hawking. I don't blame them for looking at the scientific mechanism and thinking, this is gold. This is golden. I want to follow this. This can give me truth. Where I think they have made a sophomoric mistake, and I say that with respect, because these men are far more educated than I am. I'm sure they all have brighter minds than I do. But science is not neutral. Science doesn't function independently. You have assumptions, and you have to ground the assumptions. I think the fundamental assumptions or preconditions of science fit better in a Judeo-Christian worldview.
Ken, for the sake of somebody who might be a skeptical scientist and who wants to grant that religion has benefits, that is, if it helps people behave better and we don't, you know, go around killing each other, that's good. Religion serves that purpose. But when it comes to really improving the world, we already have a long track record that scientific advance is where it's at. So I'll grant you that religion can help people cope with life or behave and not kill each other. So that's good. But if we're really going to tackle the problems of the future, climate change, you know, inequities in the world and that kind of thing, you've got to look to science. How would you respond to that?
I think what we should say to that is that science itself doesn't tell you what's good and bad. Science itself doesn't tell you whether climate change is good or bad, right or wrong. Science and technology can split the atom. We can create an atomic weapon. Utilizing nuclear energy. But the scientific method and know-how that helped us arrive at this remarkable technology can say nothing about whether it's right or wrong to use it, to drop it on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That's part of the challenge. Yes, we have the idea that human beings have inherent dignity and moral worth. But remember, that is a deeply Judeo-Christian idea. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm very happy that most people think that human beings are valuable and we should try to give them nourishment and give them a place to live and have a peaceful world. But if you're talking about science, science might lead us along the line to things that we think are beneficial, but the practice of science has nothing to say about the moral nature of it. And that's where I want to go next.
All right.
This, by the way, was entailed in a previous podcast that we had with Fuzz Rana discussing the question of human enhancement.
Yes.
Transhumanism. Transhumanism. And we have all this technology that can allow us to make various kinds of improvements, have control over things that we didn't have control over. But is it right? And is it in the hands of the wrong person can be used in dangerous and destructive ways?
Yeah, and Dave, that leads me down the direction I want to go. Here's a couple quotations. Here's one from Francisco Ayala. He is a biologist and a philosopher, longtime scientist at the University of California at Irvine. He has a quote here where he says, "In matters of values, meaning, and purpose, science has all the answers except the interesting ones." Now, what I think is intriguing about that is he's really kind of echoing another philosopher of science, Karl Popper. Popper said this. He says, quote, "It is important to realize that science doesn't make assertions about ultimate questions, about the riddles of existence." Operating limits. Are there areas in which science cannot speak? Well, I quoted two scientists. Let me quote another one, because I don't want to give you the impression that these are just philosophers who think this. This is Sir Peter Medawar, dates 1915 to 1987. He's a Nobel Prize recipient, by the way. He says this, that there is indeed a limit upon science is made very likely by the existence of questions that science cannot answer and that no conceivable advance of science would empower it to answer. These are the questions that children ask, the ultimate questions of Karl Popper. I have in such questions as, how did everything begin? What are we all here for? What is the point of living? It is not to science, therefore, but to metaphysics, imaginative literature, or religion that we must turn for answers to questions having to do with first and last things. Now, remember that we're contrasting here the practice of science. Science is an incredible discipline, and the implications of that scientific discipline in the area of medicine and technology are overwhelming. And so, Joe, to your earlier point, I don't think anybody who wants to try to find benefits to human beings is ever going to exclude this remarkable discipline. But there are limits to science. Now, what might some of those limits be? I'm going to give you five. I think there are more, but I think these five are very important. The question here is not science, it's scientism. Science is a discipline that reveals truths about the natural world. Scientism is a philosophical worldview that says the world is all there is. And even if there are multiple worlds or a multiverse, it's still natural. So you're just extending the naturalism, if you will. So nature is all there is, and the only way of knowing anything true is through science, or in a weak way, science is the best way of knowing. But those are struggles. So what are the operating limits of science? Math and logic. These are principles that are necessary for scientific theorizing and foundational assumptions upon which science depends. That math works, that logic is valid. It's not like they went out and determined these things. Again, Dave, there is a sense in which the practice of science seems to confirm, but math and logic are not determined to be valid based upon science. Science builds on the truth of math and logic. And so that's a particular area. Now remember how strong that is. Logic and math are critical features of science, but the scientific method did not validate or justify those things.
So when it comes to things like equations, where did those come from then? How do you think the skeptical scientists would answer that?
I think they'd have to say something like this. I think they'd have to say that this remarkable mechanism of evolution, that the brain reached a state where it produced a mind, and this remarkable mind was able to come up with the capacity for either inventing or appreciating mathematics.
I mean, I think, you know, the various people who discovered, like Newton, discovered the inverse square law for a description of how the Earth moves around the sun, or the moon moves around the Earth. And the fact that he could describe that motion in such a simple mathematical expression is a remarkable thing. Why should it? Why should there be a correspondence between this simple model, this mathematical description, and what we observe out there in nature? And I think, you know, each person, each scientist or, you know, predecessor who developed Galileo in showing how bodies drop by an inverse square law or accelerate by, you know, in certain ways under gravity. All of these things were just sort of ways to describe what he was seeing, and it was able to describe it in simple mathematical terms. Mm-hmm. And I think that was where the correspondence between the two began to be visible.
Yeah, this congruence that you talked about.
This congruence, right? Okay, so math and logic are not validated by the scientific method. They are ideas that provide the foundation for science. two metaphysical truths. So ideas like there exists a real external world, a mind-independent world. It's not illusion, that there are other minds, right? I haven't seen your mind, Joe. I've seen what I think are causal, are reasons for me to think you have a mind. I haven't seen Dave's mind. I have, though, reasons to think that he has a mind. But again, these are metaphysical truths, that there are other minds, that we're not a mind in a vat. Or that the universe has been here for more than 5 minutes. And so the idea is that there are metaphysical ideas built into science, that that the world is real.
Ken, if somebody says nature is beautiful, is that what you're getting at here? That's a metaphysical truth, but it's not a scientific idea?
Well, that actually takes us down to point number four.
Oh,
so I'm going to hold you off I'll come back to that.
Good.
But so mathematical and logical truths don't seem to be justified or validated by science. Metaphysical truths, like there's a real world, that other minds exist. Ethical beliefs, that there are certain things that are right or wrong, good or bad, and that the Nazis did the bad things and the wrong things. Science doesn't speak to questions of the moral ought, the moral good. What's right? What's wrong? That can't be determined by science. But
I guess you could say you can determine some things in the sense that it doesn't say what's good, but it does say that, for instance, a certain kind of thinking is beneficial for a larger group of people than some other kind of way of dealing with it. I mean,
but it tells you nothing about the moral ought.
Why it's
what is good or
right.
Or should you do it? Right? Who was it, one of the leading scientists that developed the atomic weapon, agonized over, should we use this? Right? What was his name?
Oppenheimer?
Oppenheimer. Should we use this? And what doors have we opened up here?
Right.
I heard Dave, CBS program, talking about, maybe it was one of the anniversaries of the dropping of the bomb in Nagasaki, that the ground temperature was 7,000 degrees. Well, now you get into all these moral debates. Well, should we have used it? Did it bring an end to the Second World War? How many people were murdered in the Second World War?
Part of the justification that people use for why it was good to use it has to do with some evaluation of, well, we saved so many lives.
That's because, right. Which science says nothing about.
Well, it gives you the information. It helps you to tabulate, you might say, and to correlate the information and make comparisons. So you killed 100,000 people here, but you saved 1 million soldiers.
But that in itself is a moral consideration. And what I mean
by— Why is it better?
What I mean is, should I have done that? Is that the right thing to have done? All the atomic weapon tells you is you push this button and here's what the physical results will be, right? Number four, aesthetic judgments. Again, my wife and I are taking an evening walk after dinner, and somebody said that there was some particular astronomical reason why the sunset was so red at the time. All my science friends are always looking for some scientific explanation.
Right.
My wife would say, it's just beautiful.
If there's some clouds, that might contribute to it.
Aesthetic judgments, matters of beauty, aesthetic taste cannot be determined by science itself. And then science itself, number five, It's built upon these. So think about the importance of math and logic, metaphysical truth, ethical truth, aesthetic truths, and even the practice of science. So science has limits. And what the Christian worldview would say is that these other particular areas or sources of knowledge give us truth. At RTB, we talk about the two books, the book of nature, the book of scripture, special revelation, general revelation. God is speaking to us. I mean, how important, after all, is morality? Well, I think we measure the success of a person's life in whether they're a moral person or not. I mean, if Bill Gates, I mean, here's a guy who's, how many billions does he have?
40 or some number like that.
Some extraordinary, I mean, do you get tired of counting the billions after a while? I mean, here is a guy who is a remarkable thinker. He is a remarkable businessman. He has built an enormous business that's given lots of people jobs and produce products that have changed the world in many respects. But what if you came to the consideration that Bill Gates was basically an immoral person, a highly unethical person? By the way, there are some people who criticize him for his his practices. But my point here is, no matter how successful you may be in terms of making money or having a big influence, I often say Einstein, in my opinion, shouldn't have been the man of the 20th century. It's Winston Churchill. There are some people who'd say...
Who?
There are some people. There are many college students who would say, who? They're like an owl. Who? Actually, if you want to know who had arguably the biggest influence on the 20th century, his name was Adolf Hitler. But who wants to put Adolf Hitler on the cover of Time magazine as the man of the century? This is my point. Hitler had a huge influence. I mean, if I told you where he came from, living on the streets, a man who barely survived World War I, he went from unemployed person to within a hair's breadth of controlling the entire world. I mean, that's a story to be told. Mm-hmm. Hitler, I've got books in my library on Hitler. If for no other reason, he's fascinating. But now here it is. Was he in any way a success? The success or failure of Hitler is not on whether the Germans won World War II. It's the Holocaust. This was an evil man. How important is morality? How important is beauty? How important is math and logic? It seems to me that when intelligent people want to answer questions, they reach into this toolbox, and the toolbox is the toolbox of math and logic and science. But now the question is, what worldview seems to make the most sense of that toolbox of intelligibility?
Ken, would you say that, for example, if a person who holds a scientism view were to lecture a bunch of college students and start off the lecture by saying, here is why you need to go into science, and then whatever else follows it, would you say that right at the get-go that there's some philosophical reasoning going on?
Yeah, okay. I was having a conversation with my wife, and I was saying to her, honey, what if I would have become a banker or maybe a lawyer, although not all lawyers or bankers are necessarily independent wealthy. But I said, what if I had become a banker or a lawyer? And I said, you and I'm 61. My wife's going to turn 60 this year. I said, we could probably retire and we'd have my 401k would be exponentially, to use a math term, Dave, exponentially higher than what I had. And my wife said to me, yeah, but in your spare time, you'd still be reading philosophy.
The philosophy of banking.
the reality is that, it kind of stings to know if I followed the humanities or the social sciences, I might end up with a job starting out with 40 grand, but a guy or a woman who gets a degree in engineering might start out more than double that. But then the question is, well, how do I measure the good? How do I measure my calling in life? Maybe I can have a greater impact working in a career that makes less money, but it is a career that has an influence I think I'm called to do. How do we make these these are what we're talking about, aren't we? Value judgments. And so I have to say this. I have a real respect for you, Dave, because when I took that physics class, I was like, man, it really made me work to get through four units. That's another thing I didn't appreciate about science. You had a lecture and then you had to go to the lab. And I was like, I should get double.
Right.
The work I do in the lab is more on top of the lecture. And I take biology classes. Okay, well, come and hear the lecture. And then you got to go do the lab. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, are you kidding me? And then I meet Dave and he says, I got a PhD in physics. And I'm like, man, can I shake your hand? Science is a remarkable discipline. And scientists have specialized training, and they have sacrificed a lot to get through that education. And what I want to say in a program like this is that I have admiration for science and for scientists. But don't think for a moment that the enterprise of science is neutral or independent of worldview considerations. Do not make that mistake. And quite frankly, I think Peter Atkins has made that mistake. Stephen Hawking, who may have been one of the brightest minds on the planet, has made that mistake. Someone as bright as Krauss or Sean Carroll, extremely bright people. But I think a little bit of philosophy would help very much. And there really is a fundamental difference between the practice of science, the venture of science, the enterprise of science, and the philosophy of scientism. So these are worldview considerations. By the way, this is a book that I'm working on. It's not the primary area, but there are three chapters on science, faith. For example, I ask the question, has science made God unnecessary? Then I ask the question, why do I need faith when I've got science? So these are some of the ideas I'm working through. And Joe, as one of my editors, you'll be steeped in it, correcting, telling me where I've repeated words and failed to develop things, which I greatly appreciate.
Looking forward to receiving it. All right, Kent, thank you for your thoughts on this. We hope you have found them helpful.
Could I add just a couple resources?
Yes.
I think, for example, Hugh Ross in his book, The Creator and the Cosmos, gives you some background to the idea that some of the great discoveries of the 20th century in terms of origins have worldview Christian roots. RTB produces books that tries to show that. And we've got a good number of resources that I think are helpful to people.
Mm-hmm. Very good. You might check out Jeff Swearing's book as well.
Yes.
Escaping the Beginning. That is out now, so make sure you read that. All right. We'd like to hear from you. Let us know your comments and questions. You can reach Ken on Twitter at RTB_KSamples. This podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. For Ken Samples and Dave Rogstad, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory but truth. Thanks for listening and join us for the next edition of Straight Thinking.
Thank you for listening. Your prayers and financial support are reaching people with reasons for faith in Jesus Christ, our Creator and Savior. To allow Reasons to Believe programs like this to continue, make your gift today at reasons.org.